Word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The murder of six people in Isla Vista, California, 2 weeks ago follows a pattern that has become tragically familiar. A lone gunman with a cache of weapons and a grudge goes on a rampage, randomly killing innocent people before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The tragedy reignited a national debate about mental illness, violence, and easy access to guns, the latter painfully questioned by Richard Martinez. His son, Christopher, was among the victims.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live?
Politicians, analysts, and Facebook posts tell us that these massacres could be prevented with an improved mental health care system. Then mentally unstable people like Elliot Roger could be identified and stopped before buying guns. Our guest, Richard A. Friedman, disagrees. He's professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at the Weill Cornell Medical College. His op-ed, Why Can't Doctors Identify Killers, appeared in the New York Times. Dr. Friedman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So you do not think that improving our mental health care system would prevent these mass shootings. Why not?
Well, I think the reason is that, first of all, it's important to realize these are extremely rare events. So it's a bit like looking for a needle in a haystack. They account for about 0.1% of all homicides in the United States. That's the first thing. The second is most of these people, with the exception of a few of them, tend to avoid the mental health system entirely. They're isolated, angry, paranoid, usually young men who avoid the mental health system. That's not true of Elliot Roger, who had contact with the mental health system, which brings up the third point, which is our ability to determine and predict who's likely to be violent, even when we see them and evaluate them, is no better than chance. In other words, with the current state of science and epidemiology, we're not actually very good at predicting who's likely to be violent for a couple of reasons. One is people can withhold that information. If they're psychopathic, they can lie, they can be in treatment, they can be in evaluation, and simply never tell anybody. And the other is that even though we know what some of the risk factors for violence are, the vast majority of people who actually have that profile, for example, being a young male who's psychotic and angry and abusing drugs, those are very powerful risk factors for violence. Most people who have those risk factors in that profile will never be violent.
And to your second point, in the case of Elliot Roger, his mother did call the police in Isla Vista, who visited him, and he was
right.
able to assure them that he was, you know, just fine. Polite, I think the police said. Is this characteristic of a psychotic or a sociopathic personality?
It's more characteristic of someone who's sociopathic or antisocial. Those are synonymous, meaning somebody who basically is in control, knows exactly what they're going to do, and is planning and scheming something terrible and does everything possible to conceal it. I mean, that said, I think it's important to make the point that, I mean, I believe that we should do everything possible to identify people who are likely to be violent in advance, meaning, you know, the public should be educated to look for the warning signs. I mean, in this case, there were several. He posted videos. He was odd. He made many people along the way during his life worry about him. And in recent months, you know, even his mother went to the police. I would say, given that, it's remarkable that the police just showed up at the door and took his report, a snapshot of him at that one moment, as evidence that everything was okay, against the mother's concern that he was somebody who was at risk. Of course, it might flood the system with false alarms, which is probably what will happen. But if the public is educated to lower the bar, in a sense, to, you know, report to friends, family, and the authorities, anybody that they think is at risk, which is what some people are arguing, you know, it may be helpful.
You mentioned right off the top that a very small percentage of mentally ill people are violent. Is there any
right.
evidence that psychiatric treatment for violently mental ill people would help if they were identified?
Absolutely. In fact, there's very good evidence that if you treat people who have the mental illnesses that are associated with violence, the violence is actually linked to the illness. And once they're treated and they're better and they improve, the risk of violence drops dramatically. So just so your listeners can understand, 4% of all homicide and violence in this country can be attributed to the mentally ill. That means 96% of all violence in this country is perpetrated by normal people. 96%. So it's a tiny amount of violence that gets an enormous amount of press attention. Of course, a mass killer is a horrifying event, which, like a plane crash, gets enormous media attention, and it tends to, you know, warp our sense of risk. Elliot Rodger is of those 0.1% of killers who are responsible for 0.1% of all violence in the United States. That's a tiny, tiny number.
How about other factors, not just psychiatric illnesses, but you point out that drug and alcohol abuse are even more powerful risk factors for violence.
Yes. I think it would surprise most people who are listening to know that somebody who abuses drugs or alcohol, for example, an intoxicated businessman in a suit walking down the street, is far more dangerous and more likely to assault you than a muttering, psychotic young man lying in the street. Drugs and alcohol raise the risk of violence nearly 7 times the risk of people who don't have a mental illness and don't use drugs.
Well, there are laws in place that do prevent or make it more difficult for diagnosed psychotics or mentally ill, prone to violence individuals from buying guns. What are those laws?
Well, we have several of them, and then they're well-intentioned. For example, in New York, we have the SAFE Act, which, you know, requires clinicians to report to the state authorities anybody who they feel clinically is at risk of being violent, so that if they try to purchase a gun, they'll be prevented from purchasing a gun. The problem is, of course, one, we're not very good at predicting who is risky. Two, it may have the unintended effect of driving people away from mental health treatment, because if they're worried they're going to be reported and be in a database, they may just shun us entirely. The third problem is, of course, that, you know, people can buy guns or obtain guns illegally, and the country is awash in unregistered illegal guns. We probably have 500,000 of them floating around. So even if you can turn off the spigot, even if you had reasonable gun control, there'd still be an enormous pool of weapons that would be available, you know, to obtain illegally.
Dr. Richard A. Friedman is with us. He's professor of clinical psychiatry at Cornell Medical College. And we're talking about why doctors can't identify killers, even those mentally ill people who might be prone to violence. So in the case of Elliot Rodgers, he had not been institutionalized or involuntarily hospitalized. He had been prescribed, I believe, with an antipsychotic drug that is associated with treating schizophrenia. The question here is, would lowering the threshold for involuntary psychiatric treatment be effective in preventing mass killings?
Probably not, largely because these people never reach our offices or our emergency rooms in the first place in order to be evaluated and potentially involuntarily treated. They avoid us. We might succeed, and I actually am in favor of lowering the threshold. Currently, the threshold is set at, you know, if somebody is imminently at risk of hurting themselves or others, meaning, you know, they have a plan, they've issued a threat, you can involuntarily treat them. To many people, that seems like, you know, the acting, you know, too late. Why must we require imminent threat? Isn't preponderance of risk reasonable enough in order to treat people against their will, so long as they're ill and they lack judgment to see that they're sick and at risk? And I think the answer is it's reasonable to lower the threshold. Again, the risk might be that if people realize that they're likely, more likely to be involuntarily treated, they might not show up for evaluation in the first place, because a lot of people are afraid of being involuntarily treated. A lot of patients will come into the office in the emergency room and say things like, you know, in response to a question, are you thinking about hurting yourself or hurting someone else? They may say, you know, I really don't know that I want to tell you that because you're going to hospitalize me if I tell you the answer. That happens all the time. So we're up against that. But again, I don't think These things may have an effect on the margins of lowering the risk of violence for the mentally ill, which is actually a very small contributor to violence overall in the country. I think it will have almost no impact on mass killing. What might have an impact on mass killing is to do a public education campaign so that everybody is involved in identifying risk factors, and friends and family, you know, warn appropriate authorities that, you know, somebody seems odd or at risk and they're worried because they're issuing threats, they're acting in a very odd, frightening way. That may have an effect. I think, you know, as a society, we probably should be educating people to recognize these risk factors.
I'm wondering, Dr. Friedman, with such small prospects for making a difference, why do you think this is a topic of conversation over and over again, that we can somehow identify people who have the potential for risk, and therefore, if we stop them, we stop the violence?
Because it's a natural impulse to believe that, you know, something which is so horrifying, in hindsight, we learn about their behavior in hindsight, and we see that there were warning signs, things that, you know, in the light of day now appear to have put the person at risk. So we think, why couldn't we have stopped this? To my mind, you know, the problem is that, you know, we have an enormous amount of violence in this country that is related to guns. If you think about the fact that 96% of all homicide in this country is carried out by normal people, the majority of whom are actually using guns to do this, I think focusing on the mentally ill gives people the sense that, you know, there's a relatively small group of very scary people out there that contain the risk so that they feel safer, whereas actually, statistically, the risk is all around us. So it psychologically provides an effect to make us feel a bit safer, to think that all the risk, all the danger is being expressed by a very small population in this country.
So what I'm hearing here is mentally ill people, because they have access to gun, therein lies the danger.
No, I would say normal people who have access to guns, therein lies the danger. Because if the vast majority of violence in this country is carried out by normal people in the grip of everyday emotion who happen to have access to a gun, you know, in the old days, a dispute or an argument, you hear this all the time, would end up in a fist fight. Someone would get slapped, someone would get punched, someone would be kicked. At the worst, someone would be stabbed by a knife. Now, the fact that people have such easy, unfettered access to weapons means that what would normally have been a small altercation can turn into a homicide.
We should note, of course, that the first three victims of Elliot Rodger were indeed knifed to death.
Yes.
Dr. Friedman, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard A. Friedman, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at the Weill Cornell Medical Center. You'll find a link to read his op-ed, Why Can't Doctors Identify Killers, at wordofmouthradio.org.